Okay, well, let's dive right in because that is actually where I wanted to start, is the topic of
Okay.
diving right in. So obviously we're going to chat all about Sapir's Israel at 75 issue, where there were a number of essays that I learned a lot from, some that I really disagreed with and some that I really agreed with, which I think is the mark of a good Sapir issue. But I wanted to start with yours, not just because you're the one I'm talking to, but because I thought it said something critically important, which is this right away from your first line. Israel, the most striking geopolitical fact about Israel on its 75th birthday is its power. So I want to start there because I feel like, and we'll get into this with a number of essays, but I feel like growing up as a young American Jew concerned about the security of the state of Israel, we hear a lot about Israel's weaknesses and things that we, in theory, need to do to help Israel, to save Israel, to worry about Israel. But we don't really often kind of start from that assumption that actually Israel is this astonishing power. And it's not just compared to, other new or young countries, but just in general, compared to the world at large, Israel is this really strong power. So when you say that the most stunning fact about Israel's existence at this point is its power, what specifically is coming to mind for you?
Oh, so many things, Daniela, and I really want to thank you for taking your time to talk about this essay and this issue. We usually do it the other way around. I first visited Israel in 1983, and while the country was not, you wouldn't call it a third world country, it was definitely not a first world country. I remember several years later when I was spent a summer on a kibbutz Hefsiba in the north, simply to make a phone call to tell my parents that I was alive and well was a half hour process of waiting for an operator. In those years, Israel experienced hyperinflation and experienced its first serious reversal in a war. I mean, there were reasonable doubts about whether the country could really hold itself up for the long term. And then when I became engaged in a professional way with Israel's politics, again, Israel seemed like a fragile state in a small place struggling to absorb about 800,000 or 1 million Russian immigrants. I moved to Israel at the very beginning of 2002 to become editor of the Jerusalem Post. And that was at the period of the Second Intifada. Israel felt very vulnerable, very raw. People talked about Israel going the way of Argentina economically. It was a really bleak period of time. And so now, fast forwarding a little more than 20 years, it amazes me how on nearly every dimension, on nearly every metric, Israel is outperforming its, never mind its immediate peer group of countries, but much larger powers. I mean, Israel has a higher GDP per capita than Japan. It attracts more foreign direct investment than the United Kingdom. When I was in Israel, signs of Israeli wealth were very few and far between, maybe a neighborhood in Herzliya or a couple of other places. Now you visit Israel and the thing that strikes you, of course, are property prices are through the roof. There's visible evidence of wealth. In the 1960s, Israel armed itself with British Centurion tanks and American Hawk anti-aircraft missiles. Today, Iron Dome defends the American air base in Guam from the possibility of missile attack, and the British equip their troops with the Trophy defensive armor systems. So Israel is not just a little country kind of punching above its weight, as people used to say. It's now a country with real weight. Its population, close to 10 million, is just behind Sweden's. So, okay, it's not a huge country, but it's not a small one either.
I want to interrupt you here because I think one of the things that gets muddled in this conversation is these are all facts you're talking about, but are they part of the national story that we're telling ourselves? Has the narrative around Israel actually meaningfully changed in the last 30 or 40 years? I worry because the conversation around so many of these issues today is so hierarchical. Who's at the top of various power structures, and God forbid anyone's successful, and we have to talk about who gets to compete as being the most underdog in various ways. And obviously Israel's origin story was this incredible triumph of the underdog. But eventually when the underdog triumphs, it might not necessarily be the underdog anymore. And I feel like I haven't really seen the Jewish community evolve in the way that we tell ourselves that story. So I want to understand from your perspective, Israel's power, aside from obviously that actually providing safety and security and economy and all of that, on a fundamental philosophical level, is having that kind of power a good thing? And do you feel like we're going to be able to shift the narrative of how we talk about having power?
So it's such a great question, because to some extent, Jewish identity, certainly in my parents' generation, has fundamentally revolved around an idea of the Jewish underdog or Jewish powerlessness. And there are some comforts to that concept of identity. The victim is always the presumptively virtuous party. I mean, that has been a part of not just Jewish identity, but in general, a Western perception of virtue for a very long time. Being seen as powerless equipped us to see the world in a particular way that was, in many respects, correctly defensive, correctly concerned, but also perhaps excessively pessimistic and unprepared to deal with what it means to be successful. I think it's a vastly better thing. I think, in fact, it's the fulfillment of Israel's mission to end Jewish powerlessness. That's why you would seek sovereignty, statehood, a military, all the accoutrements of statehood in the first place. And I think it requires a number of adjustments. One of the adjustments for the American Jewish community is actually the need, and this is a point that Michael Steinhardt makes in his essay, is the need to think of Israel in a different way. I mean, for the past 75 years, Israel was Jewish America's favorite charity case. There is a very large, it's not even a cottage industry, it's an industry of NGOs and nonprofits raising money for Israeli ambulances, for example, or insisting every 10 years that Israel receive another multi-billion-dollar tranche of American military assistance. And it's the way in which the Jewish American community has kind of adapted itself in the last many decades. But that needs to change. I mean, there is a question, and I raise this in my essay, why the state of Israel, which is exporting military equipment on a large scale and has a $500 billion GDP, why the state of Israel should be receiving a military assistance package from the United States. I get the argument, it's a tie that binds. The jobs anyway go to, you know, Lockheed and Boeing and other large American defense manufacturers. It's a way of preserving this relationship. But does it really make sense anymore? I mean, we don't do this with other countries at a similar level of GDP. At the same time, we need to start thinking of ourselves as an American Jewish community, not in terms of what we can give Israel, but in terms perhaps of what Israel can give us. And Israel can give us important things. Israel can give us a sense of what Jewish culture is like when it's at its most dynamic and can thrive. Israel can give us great TV shows like Fauda and Shtisel. Israel can give us a vibrant Jewish language, Jewish literature, Jewish pop music, liturgical music, all kinds of things that we as an American Jewish community need, because we are, in fact, the community that's really struggling.
Well, I want to pick up on that, because Steinhardt wrote something else in his essay that I thought was a little bit haunting, but pretty important question, which is If Israel is doing so well, isn't it fair to ask whether it really needs the diaspora's financial support and whether we haven't been using our own donations as a way of avoiding our own much deeper problems?
Yeah.
To me, I think this question is important for us to explore when we talk about Israel at 75, because Israel at 75 is a standalone. Sure, great. It's a feat for sure. It's important. But the reason people are excited about Israel at 75 more generally is because it means for 75 years, the world Jewish community has had this safe haven, and the world Jewish community has had this place to look to and say, okay, that's where I belong. No matter what happens to me somewhere else, no matter what changes, I know I'll always have that place. And so to flip it on its head a little bit, at 75, do we need to take stock of reimagining our relationship, not just to your point about whether or not Israel receives aid and whether it's a client state with the US and how that works, but forgetting about looking at the two states, Israel and the US, how do we shift the relationship between American Jewry or diaspora Jewry more generally and Israeli Jews? And I think one of the things that Steinhardt brings up that I would love to hear your take on is this notion that we've been avoiding our own bigger problems. And obviously we can talk about, you know, the number of Jews who are intermarrying and no longer raising their kids Jewish and all the changes that are happening with people no longer identifying as Jewish, practicing any kind of Judaism. So is he right? Have we been paying almost too much attention to Israel? And has it cost the, you know, whether or not American Jews are thriving here?
Look, I mean, I think that certainly the vast majority of American Jews are going to pay attention to Israel, and rightfully so. And by the way, people can use their philanthropic dollars however they wish. So if they want to continue to buy ambulances for Israelis or build schools in Israel or plant forests or whatever, you know, it's fully their right to do so. But I think Steinhardt puts his finger on a really important issue, which is that we have been avoiding in the United States the question of the crisis of the American Jewish community. And we've been avoiding it for, I think, a particular reason, which is that on the individual level, my sense is that most American Jews are doing pretty well, right? I mean, they're thriving financially, academically, professionally. I mean, obviously, I'm speaking in generalities here, but I think it's fair to say that the American Jewish community, according to most metrics of happiness and achievement and success, is doing just fine. But that's at the individual level. Take a look at the community level. To me, a very striking fact is this, Daniela. There are 4.3 million American adults who identify both culturally and religiously as Jewish. Doesn't necessarily mean they're in shul every single week, but it means they're at least doing something to affirm their sense of being Jews in a religious sense. 4.3 million American adults. There are 8.6 million Americans who had at least or have at least one Jewish parent. That means the attrition rate for American Jewry is 50%.
That's catastrophic.
Now, that's catastrophic. And that's not the only factor at work here that really ought to concern us. American Jewish women have the lowest fertility rate of any ethnic group in the world, of any ethnic group in the United States. It's just about one child per mother. The only way in which there's a compensatory factor here is that religious Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox Jewish women have many children, right? Many, many, many more children. So the character of the American Jewish community, even as it shrinks, is also changing. It's becoming a much more Orthodox in terms of its religious observance. And that's a trend that's going to naturally accelerate over time. So the American Jewish community that you and I know, right? That's what is really dwindling here. And you have to ask yourself, well, is this something that we're interested in preserving? In theory, we are, but when you have an intermarriage rate that over the last 12 or 15 years has been north of 60%, clearly we're not all that interested in maintaining this aspect of American Jewish life. So Steinhardt puts his finger on something that's really important, that even as we're doing well individual, we are doing very badly collectively. And people should not forget that, you know, 100 years ago, Daniela, there was a thriving Swedish-American community with Swedish-American churches, Swedish-American newspapers, Swedish spoken as a common household language in large parts of the United States because of the large Nordic emigration, you know, places like Minnesota, in the late 19th and early 20th century. That is totally gone. And there is no law that says that it's not going to happen also to the American Jewish community if we're not thoughtful about it.
I think this goes back to the point you made a minute earlier about what we consider successful on an individual level versus a communal level, right? For the average American Jew, assimilation on an individual level might be a good thing. You might have better job prospects, you might make more friends, you might have a more diverse community, you might make more money, your kids might get into better schools. A lot of good things happen to you as an individual when you leave the shtetl. On a communal level, a little assimilation's good. We get outside our, you know, our own circles, we make friends, we're, you know, we again are in the real world. But the most successful integration and assimilation is really just disappearing as a unique entity. And I think that your exact framing here about what counts as success as an individual, especially in this country where individual success is, you know, kind of the pinnacle of everybody's everyday get through the grind versus how that affects us as a community, is one that's really important. I want to ask you one thing, because obviously, you know, you specifically mention, I'm just pulling it up here, you mention the foreign aid that's delivered to Israel, and you talk about whether we need to shift from this client patron state. One of the things that I think about a lot is when we talk about the strains of isolationism that are reemerging in certain portions of the American political public, aid to Israel is something that's brought up on both sides. Right? On the left, it's, why are we funding Israel? Israel is this horrible, apartheid, genocidal state, and you know, we shouldn't give people money who are doing bad things with it. And on the right, it's, why are we giving Israel money? We could be building bridges here, and Israel really doesn't need our money, which I think in the safety of this Zoom room, we all probably can agree. Like, the numbers are silly at this point. It's, you know, nice that the US and Israel are aligned politically and have similar interests. And as a gesture of that, you know, we are getting some, giving some support to the Israelis, but practically speaking, to your point, Israel's doing fine economically. It doesn't need that aid package. Are we at a point where, as a Jewish community, we are ready to say that and to change the dynamic of the relationship?
Well, that's an important question, because there are, there are large institutional reasons why people want to keep things pretty much as is. There are entire organizations that exist to maintain, you know, to work towards the 10-year renewal of the assistance packages. I think those organizations really have to reinvent themselves. You know, in my essay, I envision two sort of broad strategic options for Israel. And that is assuming that Israel doesn't shoot itself in the head.
We'll get there in a minute.
More of a political balagan, but I talk about them as a kind of one of them is enhanced, what I call enhanced incrementalism, which would say that, you know what, next assistance package, which is coming up in a couple of years, should be Israel's absolute last. It is insane that Israel doesn't just buy military equipment that it needs through foreign, you know, the usual methods by which the British buy American-made F-35s or South Koreans or Japanese, the same thing. But Israel also, I think, has to plan on being potentially even more independent, because you were talking about some political currents, both on the left and the right, which now look very much askance, never mind at the question of America's relationship with Israel, but askance at the way in which America has defined its role in the world. Since the beginning of the Cold War, as the kind of guarantor of a liberal world order. And Israelis now need to think about how they might use their power in what I call a post-Pax Americana world, not a post-American world, but post-Pax Americana. That is to say, when the United States, even as powerful as we will remain, will decide not to police global conflicts the way that we have traditionally since the end of World War II. And that's going to require Israel to become, if anything, even more assertive, robust, and muscular in terms of the way in which it conducts itself as a global power.
Well, I want to ask you about some of those changing winds, because, you know, you teased a little bit in your piece, you didn't get into it that much, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. Obviously, the conversation about Saudi and Iran a year ago and the conversation about Saudi and Iran right now are very different. If you had asked me a year ago, you know, are these two countries ever going to collaborate on anything? Or can we guarantee that they're enemies and that therefore that, you know, in the words of Bibi, my enemy in the Middle East is my frenemy. These were certain things you could take for granted. And, you know, you mentioned this conversation between them. You say that we're not sure yet. Is it, you know, just a softening sort of detente, or is it the beginning of a complete realignment of the region? You leave that question open-ended. I'd love to hear what your gut is telling you about that right now.
My gut tells me that the Sunni-Shia split is something that runs so deep that no bit of diplomacy by the Chinese mediating kind of a restoration of, you know, minimally normal relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran is going to make that much of a difference. Why? Because these nations have fundamentally incompatible strategic interests. Iran is an expansionary state that has ambitions with almost all of Saudi Arabia's neighbors, including Yemen, Qatar, certainly Bahrain, and in fact, the Shiite portions of Saudi Arabia itself, not to mention Syria and Iraq. And bringing a Saudi ambassador back to Tehran or an Iranian ambassador back to Riyadh isn't going to make that much of a difference. Second way of reading it is to say the Saudis are basically saying to the Americans, don't take us for granted. And we are not happy with the way in which we have been treated, particularly by the Biden administration in the last couple of years. We have strategic options, and they could be inimical to America's strategic options. I think that was also a signal that was being sent. And the third aspect with respect to Israel is to signal that there is that Saudis are not prepared to go the way of the UAE, Bahrain, and the other signatories of the Abraham Accords and sign on to an agreement with Israel for a variety of reasons. One of them is ideological. They want to see a Palestinian state, or they want to see at least some movement in that direction before they want to get something for it. Some of it may be a signal of unease with the way in which things are going in Israel, certainly in the last 6 months. And part of it, I think, reflects internal power struggles within the Saudi monarchy. Not everyone is necessarily enthusiastic about a 180-degree revolution in terms of the Saudi attitude towards the rest of the Middle East and towards Israel. I think some combination of those factors is in play, but it's just difficult to say precisely where the balance lies.
Let me put it this way. On your list of top three international affairs related political concerns, is this ranking for you?
No. I guess my number one concern is in Ukraine. My number two is Taiwan. And my number three is the status of Iran's nuclear ambitions.
I want to go for a minute to the state of internal affairs in Israel, which you just referenced in terms of the last 6 months, and obviously, you know, was the subject of several of the essays in Sapir, something you bring up in your piece as well. I want to push you for a minute because I'm curious. Pretend for a minute that you're working for Bibi's government and it's your job on this call to absolutely defend the reforms exactly as they're written. Mm-hmm. What's your best case argument?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's a strong argument to be made for them, which is that the judicial reform is long overdue. the Supreme Court in Israel is vastly more powerful than the Supreme Court in any parliamentary system. No Israeli voter was consulted in giving the Israeli court that amount of power. There was never a consultative, much less democratic process for the Supreme Court to be able to exert the kind of authority that it has, the entire judiciary authority, that it has. If you want to call Israel a democracy, then you can't have unelected judges routinely overriding the will of the members of the Knesset and the elected government. And so therefore something had to be done. This judicial reform, again, I'm speaking to answer your question, this judicial reform might not be perfect and you might want to amend it at the margins, but there's no doubt that that in Israel, they need to rebalance the roles of the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary. And by the way, why should American Democrats, who have been busy insisting that the Supreme Court of the United States is overstepping its bounds through the Dobbs decision, that we might want to add new justices to the Supreme Court or term limit them, why are those Democrats the most outspoken in defending an overly assertive Supreme Court in Israel? So that's your defense.
Okay, and what's the other side? Why is this a threat to democracy that's threatening to destroy Israel from within?
Sure, because democracy, as we usually use the word, doesn't just mean majoritarian rule. Democracy also means checks and balances. Democracy means the rights of the individual or groups within, minority groups within the state, to have full possession of their rights and to have some defense of their rights against the will of a majority, particularly given that that majority is ideologically increasingly extreme in its coloration. Look at the government, of a government consisting of characters like a homophobe like Bezalel Smotrich, or an extremist like Itamar Ben-Gvir, or religious groups that want exemptions from the ordinary obligations of Israeli life. So if you believe in democracy in that fuller sense, right, not just majority rule, but minority rights, then the only institution in a small country like Israel that has consistently defended those rights is the Supreme Court. Unlike the United States, there's not a federalized system. Unlike the United States, you don't have a bicameral system or a real distinction between the executive and the legislature. The only thing you've got is the Supreme Court, and you should look at what the Supreme Court did under Justice Aaron Barak in the same way that the United States Supreme Court reinvented itself under Justice John Marshall. It's no different. And so Israelis were right to pour into the streets, because what they were defending was a concept of Israeli liberty that goes beyond the fact that Bibi was able to squeak through with 30,000 votes to a narrow majority in order to impose his views and the views of his extreme coalition partners on the rest of society.
But there's a big gap between the two things, the two arguments that you're making. And as a above average consumer of Israeli news, I feel like there are very few people. There have been a couple of pieces in tablet. There have been some things written in Hebrew. But for the English-speaking audience, I mean, I know I'm not shocking anyone on this call when I say coverage of Israel is rarely fair. But for the English-speaking audience, I do feel like we haven't really understood, and I put myself in this category as well, why there is the intensity of the reaction beyond the characters. And yeah, obviously the characters are not, they're not helping the situation. I guess my question to you is, take away all the characters, pretend everybody was, I don't know, the most sort of vanilla, milquetoast, whatever politician, not necessarily inspiring, but nobody's, you know, upset. All the characters are now neutral. On a policy perspective, what are the top three concerns with the judicial reforms? What are the ways to suggest tweaks to make changes so that we wouldn't be objecting to them? And if the reforms are necessary, period, and it's just a question of tweaking them to be right, why are we seeing so many Israelis night after night in the streets?
Well, I think Israelis are reacting not just to the substance of the reform, but the question of who is doing them and for what reason and why right now. So if you had a different Israeli leader, right, say Benny Gantz had become prime minister, or Buzi Herzog, the current president, former Labor Party leader, had become prime minister and had been pushing for reform somewhere along these lines, I think there would be a lot less suspicion. But you have a prime minister who is under indictment, who seems to be pushing for these reforms for reasons that have less to do the question of the balance of power in the Israeli quasi-constitutional system and more with his own, you know, for the benefit of his own legal predicaments and the legal predicaments of some of his coalition partners. And I think that explains to a large extent the neuralgic, visceral reaction of so many Israelis. Now, people like Gantz and Buzi Herzog will say that actually a compromise really is within reach, and that you can imagine a number of possibilities. One aspect of the reform that was really worrisome was the idea that the Knesset could overturn a decision by the Supreme Court with a 61-59 vote majority, one vote majority in the Knesset. So let's assume that you want a better balance. Why not make it 80 votes? The two-thirds standard is something that applies when it comes to approving treaties in the United States. Other aspects of American law, constitutional law, look at two-thirds when it's clearly an overwhelming majority of people feel that one institution has gotten it wrong, that you apply that standard. So let's have, say, an 81 vote override clause. So a substantial number of Knesset members in the opposition would have to feel the same way along with the majority in order to override a decision by the Supreme Court. That seems like a very sound idea. Shani Moore, in one of his essays, also proposes what he calls a fourth reading, so that if these changes are going to be enacted, it's not just the three readings within a single term of the Knesset, but a fourth reading in a successive government. So there's an intervening election that would allow you to change these. There are lots of formulae for changing this in a way that would be much more consensual and acceptable to the Israeli public.
I want to take this away from the theoretical for a second and ask you just sort of descriptively what you're seeing on the ground, your sources, your friends who work in government there. It seems like there have been conversations in fits and starts over the last 6 months around this issue. It feels like a calmer period right now. There are not, you know, hundreds of thousands of Israelis in the streets every single minute this week. Practically, what's your intuition? What's your gut? What's your prediction for how this ends up playing out? Is it just kicking the can until the next government and then the whole thing kind of restarts? Are we looking at substantive change? Are we looking at compromise?
Oh, my sense is this is going to end up in a committee and vanish from sight for a very long time. And no government, unless a right-wing government comes in with a huge majority, is going to risk this kind of social rupture ever again. I think Netanyahu needs some kind of face-saving exit. And would be eager to take the first one that he could get. I don't think Netanyahu was particularly invested in the reform beyond the question of thinking that this could provide him with some legal advantages. This is not what interests Bibi. Bibi is interested in Iran, the changing face of the Middle East, geopolitics. He's thinking of himself in Bismarck mode, and this was not how he wanted his legacy to Israel to kind of wind up. He has allies or partners in his coalition, particularly the Minister of Justice, but also others who were pushing for it much harder than he was. You know, the University of Chicago, there's a story, I'm an alum there, there's a story that it was supposed to be a Baptist university with daily prayer. And so William Rainey Harper, the founder of the University of Chicago, obviously wasn't too keen for his what he envisioned to be one of the great research universities of the world to just be another Baptist university. And so he decided to establish a committee to examine the question of prayer at the university. And until the committee reached a decision, there would be no prayer at the university. Well, as far as I know, that was in 1892, and that committee has yet to meet, right? So some similar kind of answer, some similar kind of solution might be in the offing for judicial reform, but we'll see.
So, Brett, you and I were just in Israel together last week, and we got there in kind of a roundabout way. I want to ask you to describe, if you're talking as a reporter, no opinion, no emotions, because I've tried to do this and I have not succeeded. So Brett and I went to Israel on a flight from Addis Ababa with a group of new Israeli immigrants. And they're part of a community called the Fala Shmora. They're descendants of Beta Israel. So they're descendants of Ethiopian Jews whose more immediate ancestors converted to Christianity. They say forcibly, the state of Israel has gone back and forth on whether or not they agree with that. And this was part of a group that's coming to Israel. Brett, can you talk for a little bit about the experience of being on the ground, meeting a Jewish community that so differs from the American Jewish community that, you know, is represented on this call and that you and I are part of and that you and I know really well, and what the experience of getting to Israel with this community was like?
Well, I've likened it, and I don't know if I can be kind of a straight news reporter in answering this. It was such an overwhelmingly emotional experience that I couldn't really divorce my sense of my Jewish self from the neutral observer. But I likened it to being on a time machine, but it was a time machine moving in a couple of directions. On the one hand, we were taking 111 Ethiopians from conditions that might have existed in the 11th century into the 21st century, very primitive conditions of life. And we visited the home of one group of Ethiopian Jews living in maybe not 11th century, but really profound poverty. I grew up in Mexico, and this was much poorer than the worst poverty I'd ever seen in Mexico. So moving them forward centuries into a modern state. But from their perspective, they were actually moving 30 centuries back to the time of Solomon and the Queen of Sheba and their child, Melanek, who became the first, by legend, the first Jewish emperor of Ethiopia. And they had been praying fervently, in many cases for decades, to return not to the state of Israel, to return to Jerusalem, return to their promised land. The fervor of their prayers, the attachment to their idea of a Jewish people to which they centrally belong was extraordinarily striking, extraordinarily moving, but not as moving as the sight of a son being reunited with a mother he has not seen in over 40 years. So that was not just an extraordinary experience, but in some ways defines my whole sense of the state of Israel and what the state of Israel is for. You know, we talk about Israel, Daniela, so often in terms of its power, its high tech, its achievements, the wonder of the whole thing, that we forget its original purpose, which was to serve as a refuge for the Jews who found themselves in the worst circumstances, in the gravest danger, with dealing with the deepest forms of poverty. The state of Israel isn't just for people searching for the next unicorn, right? It's for the Ethiopians, the Yemenites, the desperate Jews coming from Europe after World War II, including many of my immediate relatives. That's what the state of Israel ultimately is about, to serve as a refuge for Jews who have nowhere else to go. And by the way, the day after we came back from Ethiopia, we went to see an ulpan in Jerusalem with new immigrants. And there were a few Ethiopians there. There were also a lot of Russian men who were fleeing, almost certainly were fleeing conscription and near certain death at the hands of Vladimir Putin. And Israel was there to serve and save them too. And that to me is what the country remains fundamentally about, that it is our insurance policy, our guarantee that as Jews, we have some place to go when there's nowhere else.
Yeah, so I'm curious to hear you talk about that, because obviously the last 2-3 years, I mean, we've all read the same data of the number of Americans that have never heard the term Auschwitz, that have never heard the term Holocaust, the number of Americans who hold unfavorable opinions of Jews, the number of Americans who think Jews are wealthy and white and powerful, and what all those things mean in the context of our current sort of framing of those words and those issues. I'm curious how you think about Israel today as a safe harbor and a refuge, not for, let's say, the Ethiopian Jewish community or the Ukrainians. Obviously, there are many people that still physically need to flee something, and that's what Israel is for them, and it should remain that. But for American Jews, I don't think any of us think, you know, people are rounding us up tomorrow and putting us into camps. I personally, I'm not kept awake at night with that primary concern. At the same time, 20 years ago, as a kid on the Upper East Side, I wouldn't have thought twice if my dad was wearing a kippah, walking through the park, going to a Shabbat meal on the West Side. Whereas now, when I walk with my husband and my kids, I really sometimes stop to think about whether I want him doing that. And I don't think that's just a product of my growing up to be nervous about things. I think that's a product of the sand shifting beneath us and how people are unembarrassed to be anti-Semitic. So going back to this framing that Steinhardt gave us in his piece about whether we need to be worried about Israel and help Israel as an American Jewish community, or whether Israel has a responsibility to help us and we need to sort of stop using helping Israel as a salve and letting it allow us to stop diagnosing our own problems. How are you thinking about anti-Semitism as it's evolved in American society, while also keeping in mind this idea of Israel as, yes, the safe harbor, but not necessarily physically, not necessarily right now, not necessarily for American Jews, but still being there?
You know, when we were in Israel, it was the day Palestinian Islamic Jihad started raining rockets, hundreds of rockets on the country. And I don't know about you, but I didn't think twice about it because I knew there was Iron Dome and David Sling, and they were going to knock out 99% of the threat. And so the chances that I would have to, you know, that I would be any kind of target were about as great as the chances of being in a car accident. It's not negligible, but it's not something to keep me awake at night. Now, you're talking about anti-Semitism in the United States, and I distinguish between two kinds of anti-Semitism. There's the anti-Semitism we see, and there's the anti-Semitism we sense. And, you know, the ADL keeps careful tabs on the anti-Semitism that we see in terms of the number of incidents. We know about it, we should know about it much, much, much more vividly, but we know about it in terms of the site of attacks on Orthodox Jews in Williamsburg. All that's on the rise. But what really worries me is the anti-Semitism that we sense. That is the fact that anti-Zionism has now become a totally legitimate and acceptable position in American political discourse, not just on college campuses, but also in Congress. I don't see anyone trying to boot the squad from the Democratic Party. But anti-Zionism is 21st century anti-Semitism with very, very small differences. We hear discourse, particularly on the American far left, about privilege, right? Which, okay, isn't anti-Semitic, but ultimately disproportionately targets Americans who are quote unquote privileged, no matter how it is that they earn their privilege, sometimes by, you know, working themselves up from nothing. But anti-Semitism is a hatred that is based not on a sense of fear and contempt, it's based on envy. So when talk about privilege becomes a dominant strain of American thinking, we are getting that much closer to mainstreaming anti-Semitism. And then on the right, you hear Tucker Carlson going on about replacement theory, which is a not a racist slogan, it's an anti-Semitic slogan. Who's doing the replacing? Well, we were told who was doing that at Charlottesville. Jews will not replace us was the slogan. So all this talk about globalism today is eerily reminiscent of Henry Ford's much more candid talk about the international Jew 100 years ago. So I always say, you know, 100 years ago, Daniela, the richest man in Germany was Jewish. The most powerful, the foreign minister of Germany was Jewish. The greatest scientist in Germany, Albert Einstein, was Jewish. Most important philosopher in Germany, Edmund Husserl, was Jewish. The greatest doctor in Germany, Otto von Meyerhoff, was Jewish. It was 1922. 11 years later, you had the Nazi rise to power. So we have a history as a people where our moments of apparent ascendancy and apparent security vanish very quickly. And is that a prediction for what's going to happen in the United States? No, absolutely not. But can I discount it completely? No, absolutely not either.
You know, I think we all kind of grow up with this folklore of all the people that, you know, didn't end up coming to America before World War II because they were worried that the streets were paved with irreligiosity. We actually have that story in my family, and it's not folklore, it's true. My maternal grandmother is an identical twin, and she lived in Berlin. And the family wasn't planning on leaving because her grandparents dismissed all talk of it. They said, the streets of America are paved with religiosity. We can't do it. It's not happening, whatever. And so the whole family, all the generations, had kind of accepted that they were going to stick it out and hopefully, you know, nothing would be worse than it had been. And then one day, my great-grandmother got a letter from the German government saying that the Führer has a very special interest in identical twins. And would she bring her daughters in for like a free medical spa day? And my great-grandmother, who had absolutely no formal education at all, that was enough for her. And she was like, we're leaving tomorrow. And they packed up and left the next morning. And her parents, who had said, we're not coming to America, the streets are paved with irreligiosity, died in Auschwitz. And I think about that a lot because the reality is the streets are paved with irreligiosity. And many American Jews, to your point, the attrition rate is 50, are no longer living Jewish lives. There's a question in the chat from Stanley Spatz who said, can you discuss Israel not just as a physical refuge for Jews, but as a theological refuge for Judaism itself, given the assimilation of American Jewry? I would love to understand from you what we can do practically. You're obviously speaking to a relatively small, tight-knit community here, but it's a community with a lot of resources, connections, power, and ability to transform ideas into practical actions. So I think we're all clear on the problem. I think we all understand the good things that come with being an American Jew, but also the danger for the broader community. The fact that success as an individual American Jew and success for a Jewish American community are often at odds with each other. So what can we do in how we change our relationship with the state of Israel and how we change how we talk to our kids about the relationship with the state of Israel to ensure that we can do what Stanley's suggesting, use Israel not just as a physical refuge, but as a theological refuge for Judaism itself?
Yeah, we should think of Israel as a fountainhead. I don't mean that in the Ayn Randian sense, right? But a fountainhead of Jewish culture, Jewish ingenuity, a revived, reinvigorated religious Jewish life. I would hope that it would be along somewhat broader lines than it is today, but that's an argument or a discussion for another time. But what you had for 2,000 years was the miracle of a well, a Jewish well that somehow never quite went dry, but it got awfully close. And it would have gotten that much closer if the state of Israel hadn't been created in the modern era, where the forces moving people away from religious observance became that much stronger. Now, I think Israel does itself real damage. And I get the arguments, I understand the reason, but Israel does itself real damage by cutting itself off from streams of Judaism which are non-Orthodox, because those streams are also vibrant and meaningful and central to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Jews. And the lock that the Orthodox have, and not just the Orthodox, but a particular type of Orthodoxy has on the Israeli state, I think has been damaging. And damaging to relations between Israel and the diaspora, but damaging to the relation between one Jew and another. That's the sort of problem, the sort of issue that I suppose, I hope, is going to resolve itself over time. It doesn't rise to my top tier of problems that Israel has to face, but that's something that Israel has to confront. That being said, the amount of Jewish culture, and I mean culture in the broadest sense, including religious culture, that Israel produces, has not only reinvigorated, it's saved Jewish life itself from essentially evolving into Zoroastrianism or some ancient but very diminished religious tradition.
Yeah, I agree, but I don't know how satisfying that is in terms of the practical reality of that happening. I think one of the concerns, and I'd love to kind of tease this out with you, from the Israeli perspective, there is a dismissal of non-Orthodox forms of Judaism, but they also really don't exist in Israel the same way that they exist there.
There's a reason for that also.
Okay. Do you want to say more?
Well, I mean, you've had the Orthodox basically in control of religious life since the founding of the state. So when you say, well, there's a reason for that, right? I mean, the reason is that the Orthodox have essentially controlled religious life in Israel to their own advantage. And now you have a situation in which I think has actually managed to drive a lot of secular Israelis away from religion altogether, because there aren't particularly great alternatives for them if they're interested in some form of observance. Of course, a lot of secular Israelis, as you and I know, their non-observance is more observant than most of our own observances, right? And they observe it every day simply by opening their mouths and speaking Hebrew. Right. But Israel should provide the full menu of Jewish alternatives to Jews who want to live in that country.
Yeah. Okay, we're getting a bunch of questions along the same lines, asking why there is this idea that the U.S. shouldn't get aid, the U.S. shouldn't give aid to Israel, because, you know, we do give aid to other NATO countries. Can you explain a little bit more about why, from your perspective, this isn't just about the dollars and cents, but about the sort of vibe, dare I say, of the relationship and how that affects our conversations about what Israel does internally, how it positions itself with the Palestinians, how it positions itself with the rest of the world, et cetera?
Look, it's not like I am militantly hostile to America continuing to give aid to Israel.
That'd be a fun soundbite from this conversation.
To be clear, it's not anywhere near the top of my priorities in terms of thinking about reordering American-Israeli relations, but that aid comes with a implicit and sometimes not so implicit assumptions that there is a patron-client relationship between Israel and the United States, and that Israel is still essentially the child that's tethered by this financial umbilical cord to its mother. And that may have served Israel very well when Israel's GDP was a tenth of what it was and American military aid made up a huge gap. When Israel's GDP is approaching $500 billion, right? The idea that $3.7 billion per year makes all that much of a difference to Israel's actual security, I think, is false. But it makes a real difference in terms of the nature of the Israeli-American relationship, which is not quite a relationship of two sovereign states looking at each other as, say, Italy and the United States, or Canada and the United States still do. Obviously, the United States is a much larger country, much more power. Israel will still want to shop at Lockheed Martin the next time it wants an advanced a fighter jet. But I don't think it serves Israel ultimately in the long term well if, after all of these years and having acquired so much power, it still has that kind of relationship. I think it provides a legitimate basis of complaint, both on the political right and the political left, in terms of the nature of our relationship with Israel. And I think it hampers Israel's freedom of action, and has done so in ways not just overtly, like during the 1991 Gulf War, but often covertly, in terms of what Israel is willing to do when it finds its interests at odds with the American interests.
I agree with that. I know this is a departure from the topic of Israel, but we are getting a bunch of questions about comedy and anti-Semitism. And Brett,
comedy.
And I personally would love to hear your thoughts on this. So since I'm moderating, I'm just going to take a departure from Israel for a second and ask how you feel about Chappelle, the SNL monologue, and anti-Semitism when it appears in comedy specifically. Like, what's the line between, you know, being sort of pearl clutching and cancellation versus genuinely not loving anti-Semitism being just, you know, totally commonplace, funny, and part of the zeitgeist?
Look, I laughed.
I laughed too.
And maybe that's horrible of me, but I laughed for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think Dave Chappelle is operating in good faith. And I don't think there was animus, any kind of hatred at work there. I think he's a comic playing with his specific art form. And that's an art form that only works if you're prepared to go to the edge of what is okay to say. And quite frankly, I wish that, if Jews are going to, especially those of us who object to cancel culture, the sort of censorious nature of modern progressive culture in general, if we're really going to object to it, we need to be able to also take the joke, right? Even if we don't necessarily laugh. You know, I grew up with a rich vein of all kinds of lighthearted ethnic jokes, you know, often told at the expense of various ethnicities to which I tangentially belong, jokes about Mexico, for instance, Italian jokes, my mother was born in Italy. Okay, again, I think there's a huge question of whether the sense is that the joke is told in a lighthearted, decent, non-mean-spirited way. And I didn't see that with Chappelle. But also, look, if comedy works, it requires comedians to go right to the edge, right to the edge. And sometimes they are going to misstep. And I think it behooves us to extend a sense of kind of grace and forgiveness when they do misstep, because we want vibrant comedy. It's a good in society when people are able to, you know, to laugh. I mean, I always think of this wonderful joke of Saul and Moshe are walking down the street one day, they pass a church, it says, convert, we'll give you $10,000. Moshe looks at Saul, says, I gotta check it out, goes into the church, comes back 2 hours later, Saul says, so you get the money? And Moshe says, ugh, you people, always thinking about money. I mean, it's funny. And Jews ought to be first in laughing, not last.
Yeah. Okay. I know we have to wrap up, but I have two more questions. The first is from the chat. Bunch of questions about the judicial reform in Israel and trying to understand whether there are larger divisions at play or this is purely a right-left thing. I would actually love your take on this as well. And if you can just tease in with it, any kind of framing we should have in mind, religious, secular, Ashkenazi, Sephardi, Mizrahi, all the divisions kind of underpinning Israeli society right now, are those bubbling up in the conversations about the Supreme
Court? That's what I think the judicial reform is really about.
Okay.
Which is the changing demography of Israel. I mean, Israel was a country of, if not Yekes, overwhelmingly Ashkenazi Jews, mm-hmm. dominated the country's institutions and continue to dominate many of the country's institutions for decades. that obviously began to change back in 1977 when Menachem Begin came into power, and it broke the power of not just the left, but a certain kind of left in Israel. And it's been evolving ever since. And I think part of the reaction was a sense that if the Supreme Court were to cease to be a bulwark for protecting a certain westernized concept of rights and liberties, then the country was going to swerve into a much more religious, nationalistic, orthodox direction. So clearly more was at play than simply the legalistic questions of where the correct bounds of the judiciary vis-a-vis the legislature should be. You see this all the time. When I was first in Israel back in the 80s, I would never see soldiers or rarely see soldiers wearing kippahs. And now, and certainly not officers. And now, you know, you just can't help but notice it, that religious Zionists, religious nationalists are a increasingly dominant strain in what was once the ultimate Ashkenazi establishment, which was the military. So that's a shift that's taking place. I don't think we should overstate it, however, because if you just look at the coloration of Israeli society, the number of marriages that are part Mizrahi, part Ashkenazim, you know, it's still a melting pot of a society. And my fundamental attitude about Israel is, not only am I basically optimistic about its future, it's one of the only countries, if not the only country, about which I'm optimistic. And let me just close on this note, if I may, Dan.
Oh, no, I have such a joke to tell before you close, and one okay. more question.
Listen, in Israel, Israelis consistently report high levels of happiness. And that's surprising for a country where, you know, you send your kids to the army, you worry about them at night, you know, because God knows where they might be in harm's way. And yet Israelis always report very high levels of happiness. And I think the reason is that happiness derives from having a sense of purpose. And almost every Israeli that I know comes born into this world or born into Israel with a sense of purpose, something that you don't quite get if you're Danish or French or Canadian or American. An Israeli knows something about purpose, and purpose lies at the root of human happiness. It's not the only ingredient, but it's a major ingredient. And that's why whenever I'm in that country, no matter what's going on, rockets are being fired, I feel pretty good about the place. Knowing all of its problems, or most of its problems, I feel good about Israel, I feel good about Israelis, I feel good about the state and the direction of the country, and I'm 100% certain that my great-great-grandchildren will be kvetching at Israel at 175 and say, boy, things were great back in 2023.